Seven of Nine, tertiary adjunct of Unimatrix 01. But you may call me Seven of Nine. You are proposing a large-scale weapon. We concur.
I thought you might.
We could encase the nanoprobes in some of our photon torpedoes. In essence, turn them into biomolecular warheads.
Your torpedoes are inadequate. They lack the necessary range and dispersive force.
Do you have a better idea?
We are Borg.
I take that as a yes.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the pretty gray, a little bit of blue bridge,
it's Tyler Orton getting swept to the other side of the galaxy for a journey of the lifetime, Cam.
That's right.
And by lifetime, I mean about 7 years.
That is a lifetime, though, right?
For an O'Kumpan, yes. Just about. I think they've got 9 years, so, yeah.
But that's only the ones that are really healthy.
True. Oh, yeah, you're right. For somebody that is more of a couch potato. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
O'Kumpan. Potato? That's bad. I'm so sorry, Cam. Let us get into the nitty-gritty here. What's going on?
Yes, we are going to rank the Voyager two-parters. It has been a long journey, Tyler, since we started tackling these Voyager two-parters. Like, you know, when we did the TNG ones, we burned through them relatively quickly. But with Voyager, we had, of course, interruptions with Discovery, a couple seasons of them. And so it took us a long time to get to the end of this journey, but now it's really exciting because we get to actually rank them and decide where, you know, we feel they belong. Because when you look at lists of Voyager favorite episodes, they're all over the map. So I'm curious if our rankings of the two-parters are the same.
Yeah, one of the things that I took apart from the Voyager two-parter journey, though, is just the way that the two-parters kind of feed into the ongoing mythology of the series.
Right.
The Deep Space Nine two-parters, I'd say the vast majority of them are very much involved with the mythology, even in an episode like, say, the Maquis Parts 1 and 2.
Right.
Voyager, beyond the Borg stuff, I think there is kind of this idea like, oh, no, it's a very episodic series. I'm looking at some of these ones that we're going to be discussing, and yeah, a lot of the same themes keep coming up, mm-hmm, and a lot of the same story points and a lot of the same sort of character arcs keep popping up. And I think it's going to be actually kind of intriguing for us to delve into 12 of these feature-length episodes / two-part episodes and seeing where exactly they rank as kind of a big journey for a viewer. Like, they always felt very epic whenever they were coming on to the screen.
Totally. And I'm curious, we've done episodes ranking the TNG two-parters, ranking the DS9 two-parters. Now that you've done Voyager, which one do you think was the hardest to figure out in order?
You know, okay, so I think with our Deep Space Nine two-parters, mm-hmm, you and I were kind of on the same page for a lot of it. There's some differences.
Sure.
And I think,
yeah,
maybe the TNG ones were a little bit harder, because I wonder how much of it like kind of ties into your own nostalgia for a particular episode, like what sorts of feelings you're having the initial time and then how they measure up years later. Whereas I think it almost seemed much more objective with Deep Space Nine. Like, what did it add to the ongoing story, the ongoing mythology of Deep Space Nine? And we were blown away by the relevancy of an episode like, what was it?
Past Tense,
for example. I was getting confused because there's a very similarly named episode that we're going to be talking about later on here. But, you know, like, it's just kind of amazing with regards to that. But you said it before, like, if you ask, you know, fans what are their favorite Voyager, you know, episodes, period, not necessarily multi-part episodes, but they're all over the place. Like, there's really no agreement, unlike, say, Deep Space Nine or TNG, where there is a lot more agreement here. So I think
you'll hear, like, one or two or three episodes show up on every Voyager fan's list, but a lot of the time, it's a whole, you know, spread of different episodes.
Why do you think that is, though, Cam? Is there an explanation?
Maybe, like I've always said, that Voyager is a show that hits the good level a lot. But it doesn't hit great, you know, as much as like a DS9 or a TNG, in my opinion. Now, a Voyager fan would disagree with that, but maybe to them, it feels like the show hits the particular mark they're looking for so often that it's tough to really pick a standout episode.
So I wonder then if it often comes down to people remembering like exceptional moments, exceptional story beats, and exceptional character beats within any given episode. You know, that's why I think of an episode like Timeless, and I think that ends up on a lot of, you know, top 10 lists because it's just, you know, thoroughly a very solid episode, whereas some other ones that I see on people's lists, I'm like, okay, I remember a couple good moments in that, but is it an exceptional episode overall? I think Voyager is one, it's very tied to kind of like how engaged you are with the characters, though, and I think you'll remember a lot of the character moments more than anything else from Voyager.
For sure, and we did an episode talking about the best Voyager episodes ever, and, you know, it was tough for us to nail down.
It was so tough that we had to figure out, like, an incredibly complicated way of figuring it out, though. Yeah. It was like this bracket system, as if it was like March Madness about, you know, like which episode would beat another one in a bracket, because that's why, like, we talked about it, like, how are we going to do this in a way that's not going to frustrate people, and or people would just get bored. And I think it just kind of speaks to kind of this weird thing that Voyager has going on for it, that's not weird bad, but just very unique in the Star Trek canon.
Spoiler, Tyler really fought for the Thaw to be the greatest Voyager episode of all time.
I remember the first time I saw that, I just, like, it killed me.
Yeah.
Very much like a person in one of these cryogenic machines. But
someone needs to do some sort of mashup of the Michael McKean clown character in that episode with the Joker trailer.
Well, Cam, you know what? It Chapter 2 is coming out.
Sure, that too, yeah.
So maybe it would have been a perfect time for us to line up a Thaw retrospective, you know, with Pennywise.
Evil clowns in Star Trek.
Yeah. So, Cam, we can delve into the nuances of two-parters as well. Let's start. We're going to go from 12.
Yep.
Our last to our first. I'm very curious where things end up. Why don't you kick it off, sir? What is your least favorite Star Trek Voyager multi-part, feature-length, two-part episode, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah. I don't think this will surprise anyone who listens to the podcast. I am not a fan of The Killing Game.
Okay.
I find The Killing Game, of all the Voyager two-parters or extended stories, it's the one that I just find kind of a chore to sit through. And, like, I do have a dividing line on my 12, where it shifts into ones I like pretty quickly. But this one, I just find it's so plot-based. It feels like just a sort of holodeck adventure that I just can't really invest in. I don't find it very funny, or it feels like when I watch a lot of old movies, and you can tell the ones that were B programs versus the A programs.
Yeah.
And a lot of this World War II stuff feels like a B program, like one of the chintzy, you know, B World War II movies you see on those sets that are like 10 World War classics.
Yeah.
And it kind of rubs me the wrong way, in the same way that, like, I remember you and I talked about a holodeck episode, and I said it feels like it's not really trying to evoke great, you know, examples of that type of story versus the ones that are just like the cliches that everyone knows. And that's what I kind of find of this one. It just doesn't wow me.
So this one, it was funny, like, going into it, I actually had much fonder memories of it until we did the rewatch a couple months back. And it was about a year ago, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized it's much thinner on paper than I had recalled. The moment that actually sold me on this one way back in the day, and you and I disagree quite a bit about this, but the cliffhanger where they essentially blow up the bunker and you see like multi parts of like the ship because the holodeck is blown up.
Right.
I that moment, I'd never seen anything like that in Star Trek before. That really sold me on it. Going back years and years later, I was just like, yeah, this one isn't quite working for me. And there's other stuff where the conclusion of this episode.
Yeah.
Why did this episode conclude, Cam? Because the writer said, oh, it's over.
Yeah.
You know, it was just so silly because like we have a voiceover from Janeway saying like, we've been fighting the Hirogen for weeks now. We've come to a truce.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
I feel like this could have been like a slam bang 1 hour episode.
1 hour? You think there was like,
I think
how do you cram all of this into 1 hour?
I think
you
start cutting stuff. I think you have to, you go back to the drawing board and you just come up with the basic idea of the characters trapped in a World War II program by the Hirogen, and you write that 1 hour episode, and I think you could have gotten something really exciting.
So then you're losing scenes like Harry Kim naming his favorite parts on like a 500-year-old woman.
Yes.
Okay.
That's one part. You could also maybe cut out some of the stuff with Neelix and the Klingons. you know? Like,
look.
And Janeway and the Klingons?
Yeah, like, okay, yeah. It's kind of fun to laugh at when you watch the episode, more so ironically than, you know, as in, like, laughing with them versus laughing at them as versus with them. But
Neelix with the French bread in his basket on his bicycle is still pretty classic, though.
I just think you could have probably done this in a way where it maybe had a little more impact. Like, it feels like something that wants to be, like, a kind of a high-impact, energy-driven story, but then you stretch that to 2 hours and it just doesn't sustain it.
Okay, so here's my deal though with The Killing Game though.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this list that I've got here, and I would much rather rewatch this one again than a few others here on my list. So that's why I can't have it ranked at the bottom. So my number 12 here is actually Unimatrix Zero.
Right.
Which you take an idea.
Right.
Which I guess it works on in concept, in which, like, you know, there's some rebel Borg with, like, their subconscious has their own little sort of collective.
Yeah, like their own VR world.
Yeah, and you do really, really boring stuff with it, and you
Tyler. This Seven, is the greatest romance know, in the history of Star Trek.
You give Seven the blandest, generic 90s man love interest that they were, like, it's like he couldn't even get a callback on Melrose Place for, like, a waiter, and all of a sudden he is the love interest there. And it just did not grip me. It's a weird one though, because I know the backstory for this, in which Mike Sussman came up with a story. I think it was Phyllis Strong was his co-writer on this one. They came up with this story, and it had nothing to do with the Borg. It just had to do with, like, these aliens that had kind of like this sort of collective subconscious. And then they applied that. I think they really just tried to stick a square peg into a round hole here with the Borg issue. I think they wanted a big epic Borg episode, and I was just not invested in anything going on here. You know, I mean, there's interesting Seven stuff and Borg Queen stuff. I still think that no matter what iteration you have of the Borg Queen, whether it's Susanna Thompson or Alice Kriga, just sizzles on screen. Like,
totally.
So I cannot deny them for that. But this episode, if you're saying, hey, we're going to watch this one, I'm like, I think I need to go and rewatch Learning Curve from season one of Star Trek Voyager, the season finale, non-cliffhanger there.
Neelix's cheese, much more of a threat.
I'd much rather hear get the cheese to sickbay than, hello, Seven, we are romantic interests now.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Could you even, like, can you conjure up in your mind what that guy looks like right now?
In my mind, it's like some guy, he probably has, like, brown hair, and he's Caucasian.
No memory of him whatsoever.
There's nothing distinct about him.
Yeah.
Unlike, you know, there's actually, like, a love interest that we'll get to a little bit later on, who I actually find kind of distinct, and it's kind of funny. I think I'm higher on this love interest than you are. I'll just give it away.
Oh, this love interest? Oh, I thought you meant the guy in Unimatrix Zero.
Oh, no.
Really?
No, the love interest in Workforce. Like, I thought, like, he was actually a very distinct actor. I can conjure him up in my mind. I can conjure up his voice. This Unimatrix Zero guy, I have no clue. Just none whatsoever.
I wonder how much that has to do with the execution, though, because I think of Janeway's love interest, or not so much love interest as, like, kind of dueling romantic interest in Counterpoint. That guy kind of checks off the boxes of 90s man, right?
Yeah.
And yet, he has so much personality, he immediately jumps to my mind.
Right.
Like, I know exactly what he looks like and what his personality is. I wonder if you wrote the guy in Unimatrix Zero to be really memorable. Maybe you would.
What's his most defining, like, characteristic? I can't name a thing.
To be honest with you, at the moment, I can't remember anything
about
him.
Neither can I. So. It's just such a... Okay. You're not a big, like, Veronica Mars fan, Cam. A bunch of friends dragged you to the feature film a couple years ago.
Yeah.
You were lost.
I had never seen an episode of the show at all, and I decided to really, like, immerse myself in this movie that was the most confusing movie I've ever seen in my life.
But what I'm getting at, though, is...
I watched, like, Todorovsky's Holy Mountain, which is, like, maybe the ultimate, head-tripping movie. And, I mean, I found it easier to understand than the Veronica Mars movie.
Well, essentially what I'm getting at is Kristen Bell plays Veronica Mars, and no love interest she ever had could hold a candle to the charisma bomb that is Kristen Bell. It's just never worked. So there's a bit of controversy in this latest season, which I thought was an exceptional season. And I feel the same way. Like, if you have Jeri Ryan as, like, kind of this is the episode centered on her, you need to find a really strong love interest. And I'm sorry to say, but Robert Beltran, or at least Chakotay, again, falls into that same trap where why give these amazing women like these Blandy McBlandersons, much like how Kira was dealing with Shakaar and sure. Baryl back in the day before she found Odo. Like, I just don't understand that.
Is Seven an almost impossible character to have a romantic interest with, though?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I wonder if they address that in Star Trek Picard.
Yeah.
You know, and look, just listen to her voice in that trailer. Like, sure. It sounds as if Seven's been doing some new stuff lately.
But at this point in Voyager, like, she still has, she hasn't embraced humanity fully. Her speech has a little bit of that kind of almost mechanical cadence to it. She's very, like, you know, shields her emotions. That's a pretty tough thing to sell in emotional scenes, especially with a, you know, player of the week.
I kind of thought that the Harry Kim dynamic was kind of fun. Like, it was weird, especially since, why is Harry interested? Like, it's, like, within, like, what, 3 episodes of her appearance? It's because she's a very attractive woman.
Yeah.
If we could go beyond that creepiness there, it was kind of a fun dynamic between the two. I think it could have given, you know, Garrett Wong a lot to play off of, too. So you've got that? I don't know.
I guess you do have sort of the flirtationship with her and the Doctor for a little bit.
Yeah, you know, works. You're totally right. Yeah, I think that's actually a good... but then it gets, again, really creepy.
Sure. But I think when you're bringing, like, a player of the week and being like, okay, guy, you know, you're on set, here's your love interest, you've read the script, go. And then she's like, this very, like, mechanical type speech pattern. It's tough to find the rhythm versus, you know, both, you know, Garrett Wong and Robert Picardo have worked with her for a long time at this point. They know how to establish that rhythm. They've had plenty of practice.
Well, here's hoping 3rd of 5, a.k.a. Hugh, could get something a-going in Star Trek Picard. Cam, what is number 11 on
for
your list?
For me, it's actually Unimatrix Zero as well. And, I think it's really interesting when franchises take something that fans love about the show, in this case, the Borg, and just go that extra step to a direction that people just don't find interesting.
I know.
You know, you see it with the Borg children as well. It's just like, it's that one extra step into the world building of this element of the show that everyone loves that just does not grab people. And I feel like that's the case with the Unimatrix Zero.
What happens when you keep seeing the Borg getting defeated all the time? Then they're not actually all
they
that interesting.
Yeah.
So it's like, and we saw that again with Unimatrix Zero. So,
and it just doesn't feel like when, you know, you have the setup of Unimatrix Zero, this like virtual world. Is that something that people can really like, you know, feel suspense over?
Yeah. For me, I don't feel a lot of tension in a lot of these movies, unless you're Chris Nolan doing Inception.
Sure.
You know, these sorts of like VR / dreamscape sorts of things. Like, to me, I'm like, it's not really reality. So then it takes agency away from the characters, where I just know that if only you can just wake up, then things are going to be okay.
Yeah. Like, I don't hate Unimatrix Zero.
It's last on my list, so I guess I do.
But it just feels so flat.
Yeah.
And that's the weird thing about it.
All right. Well, my number 11, though, I got to give it to Endgame. You and I just did this one. And as a, you know, 2-part feature length episode, it's fine, but as a series finale, I ain't digging it. It just feels somewhat small in scale in a surprising way, and it feels as if like it's a ripoff of All Good Things, and a very on-the-nose ripoff. I'm like, you also do a lot of disservice to a lot of these characters, because we're essentially watching them in, I guess, the alt timeline, or I guess it would be the prime timeline until Admiral Janeway was messing up with it, but it just felt as if we weren't actually getting real resolution to the characters we've been following for years. And as an audience member, I legit felt cheated that I never actually got to see that real-time reunion with a lot of these people waiting to get home. And I get it. You know, the whole point of the story is, like, they were home this entire time. Voyager is their home. Blah, blah, blah.
To the journey.
To the journey, to quote Harry Kim once again. You know, but I just found it to be such a disappointment. And look, I don't put it last on my list. I think if it was anything but a series finale, it would be higher up, but this just does not work for me.
Okay, yeah. It's interesting talking about it, you know, as we did in Vegas with Scott Hardy for that episode, and that, like, when we talk about what we left behind, or what you leave behind, I should say, also All Good Things, there's so much excitement in the conversation about those episodes. Like, when we did both those episodes, we had a blast talking about them, and there was so much energy just breaking down all the elements and how they wrapped up their series so successfully and what it all meant for the characters. You don't really have those conversations with Endgame, which is kind of a bummer.
It's not particularly inspiring here.
No, don't walk out just being like, oh my God, the ramifications, you know, like, where did these characters go next? it doesn't introduce threads or really set it up in a way where it satisfies you, but also is like that springboard for your imagination of where the world, you know, where the future could take these characters.
If I want to cut down all good things to a certain degree, I will say that it actually does a disservice to a lot of the main cast. You know, it is a Picard story through and through.
Yeah.
What does Troy have to do in this episode? You right. know, Tasha Yar has way more to do than Troy does. So that is kind of an interesting element, though. But the fact of the matter is like, it is so exceptional in its single-mindedness towards this story that they're telling.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. I can wipe it all away. And just give me a moment with Picard sitting at that poker table.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, analogous moment in Endgame, unfortunately. And I just right. like there weren't those emotional punches that I was hoping for. And I'm sorry, but, you know, looking at Chakotay's, like, gravestone, his epitaph, that didn't really do it for me. I got more of Tuvok, though, like seeing, like, yeah. Tuvok's alt-timeline state, you know? Right. But again, it's alt-timeline. I now know that Tuvok is going to get to Earth in time to get some medical treatment.
Right.
So it kind of takes away from that emotional moment that I got with Tuvok earlier on. So that's why I'm a little disappointed. Cam, what is your number 10?
My number 10 is Workforce.
Okay, which, interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
We reviewed a while back. This, honestly, is across the line where I actually enjoy the episode.
Okay.
It's not. I'm not with the lower rungs where it's just like, this did not work for me. I enjoy Workforce. It's a really kind of classic Star Trek planet with a gimmick,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
where it's like, what if everyone was at their job all the time?
Or, I think we thought it was like the most TOS, you know, totally. Two-parter
yeah.
that Voyager ever did.
Yeah, like this one to me, I really like the gimmick of it. It's fun. I like the world building of the planet. I enjoy seeing the characters just spend a lot of time just kind of uncovering the crevices of how this world works, which a lot of the, you know, Star Trek episodes across the board wouldn't necessarily do as much. Like, because it's a two-parter, you have more time to really exploit this entire idea. But the reason, like, for me that I rank a little lower is that it doesn't impact me in a big way. Like, I don't walk out with, like, a real emotional moment that sticks with me. I think more of, honestly, when I think Workforce, I think of kind of the locations. Mm. And, you know, like, do I think of the cliffhanger of Chakotay running away from security guards or things like that? No, not really. Like, the drama of it doesn't necessarily grab me as much as just the change in setting, which I find really interesting.
I may have been on board with you, maybe a few months ago.
Right.
Then I rewatched it. We did it for the podcast, and I was kind of struck by how solid of an episode it is.
It is solid.
And you're not saying anything different. But I genuinely, maybe I just had such low expectations it blew me away. But I was like, wow, this is really an episode that is applicable to 2019. If
right.
we're just talking about kind of the differences between the classes in society, which
yeah.
I know Star Trek has addressed that you know, before, but this seems
going all the way back to the Cloud Minders.
yeah. But this seems actually even more applicable in a way that surprised me. And I was actually just struck by it. And I'll go back to like other little simple things like Janeway's got a love interest that is actually age appropriate
sure.
and actually has some yeah. personality. She's getting some nuance in like her decision whether to stick around in this life. Like she has a boyfriend for about 2 weeks and they move in together, which was curious. But
yeah.
Does this woman want to pursue life as a captain or life of happiness moving forward? Like there's a lot of fascinating character stuff in this that you wouldn't necessarily expect. Cam, I agree. I think this is a very weak cliffhanger, but look, there's a very strong two-part episode later on that we'll get to that has mm-hmm. one of the lamest cliffhangers.
Very true. Very true.
But that doesn't take too much away from me as if I view it holistically. So
we do have that weird subplot with Tom and the pregnant B'Elanna.
That was bizarre. We were mocking that mercilessly yeah. just a few months ago.
Yeah.
I cannot explain it. Cam, as a single man, how many pregnant women do you actively befriend?
And that I actively try to find them friends with children as well?
Yep.
To like hang out with?
And
all
go
the
to,
time, Tyler.
Bring her to bars, insist that she comes to a bar.
I'm currently trying to build a new social app to expand on this lifestyle I lead.
you know what? Say what you will about society. There may be legs to it. So I wish you the best of luck there. Yes, there's some weird things going on, but there's actually some fun stuff with like the ECH on the Voyager. Like we get to bring that thread up again, you know, where mm-hmm. actually it's more kind of the eye rolling period of the Doctor, where like,
right.
You know, he's trying to like undermine Harry, the Starfleet commissioned officer, versus, you know, himself just because he is programming. But
right.
I don't know, like I this one is, it's much funner than I think a lot of people remember, and there's a lot of cool character stuff going on, and I would just really push everyone to go back and rewatch this once again. This is not one that stuck in my brain in the intervening years since I initially watched this, and the time that we did our rewatch,
yeah,
I actually I like it quite a bit.
Yeah, Voyager did another episode like this, Critical Care, with the Doctor, yeah. And it's interesting in that one also tackles, you know, a very real world social issue, and I have much stronger memories of like an emotional response to that one than I've had to Workforce either of the times I've watched it.
Do you
it.
Think Workforce could have been better as maybe a one part episode?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
You would have had to lose the Tom and B'Elanna subplot.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. Just one more bizarre thing from this one that we mocked a couple months ago as well. But remember the police inspector brings a mugshot of 7 of 9?
Yep.
And Tom is like, if I saw her, I would have never forgotten that face. And then like a second later, we see like 7 of 9 walk out from behind like the bar, like she's been standing there the whole time, and yeah. Tom knew it. Creepy much? Like, wow. Anyway, Cam, let's go to actually my number 10 was The Killing Game. We okay. went into that one. To me, it's like one of those, I'm you're already in the era where you're kind of enjoying these ones.
Yeah,
the Killing Game, I would be happy to rewatch it. It's not excruciating to me, but it's just not like a strong entry for me. And that's why I have it, you know, third to last on my list here at number 10.
You know what The Killing Game reminds me of is the TNG episode Gambit. And that, like, it's this episode that I think a lot of people really enjoy. They love, like, kind of the fun adventure of it all. And it does nothing for me yeah. whatsoever. So, yeah.
Well, why don't we go to your number 9?
So my number 9 is Endgame. Endgame was one I really did jockey it back and forth with Workforce, because to me, like, I was like, you know, I have similar feelings on both, and that, like, they are, to me, kind of very, very, like, mid-tier Voyager episodes. But I gave Endgame a little bit of the bump upwards, because I think there's a certain impact it carries, kind of as a cheat, just by virtue of being a finale. There are moments that I would never forget from it because it's the finale right. of Voyager. I'm yeah. watching it with a much higher, you know, stake, personal stake in the episode. And like when I watch it, I really enjoy the stuff with the two Janeways talking. You know, you mentioned it in our Endgame review, the Janeway, you know, the prime Janeway being like, let's have our cake and eat it too. You know, it has these really memorable moments. The alternate future stuff is annoying from a storytelling point of view, but it's a little fun to see these characters in the future.
Why are you spending time on a Klingon asteroid with her, like, you know, yeah. like, it's just weird.
Yeah.
Like, there's so, it seems like more diversions where I'd rather spend time with the cast that we know.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But, you know, as a conclusion, like, it's one that's not a home run, but I go, I can accept it. It's not like These Are the Voyages. Like, These Are the Voyages enrages me even to think about.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, I'm like, you know what? Like, they tried something that was a little too similar, I think, to All Good Things, but you know, it's an okay finale. It's just, you know, not a home run, but it has enough in it that does stick with me. And even just the image of the Voyager returning home with all the fireworks going off, I'm like, it gave me a iconic image that I've always remembered since yeah. seeing it.
You I know, buy that.
It's not the best Endgame story of all time, but it's the second best.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
It's not third. It's not Highlander.
Cam, my number 9 is Flesh and Blood. And I think ultimately we both agree that there's a lot of interesting questions that they bring up with regards to holographic sentience, as well as kind of this guy with a messiah complex, the Bajoran hologram too. Yeah. It's also Janeway having to reconcile a lot of her decisions that she made previously with regards to the aforementioned Killing Game and her decision to give holographic technology to the Hirogen in order to dissuade them from hunting, you know, actual people that are made of flesh and blood.
Right.
But this is one where I just falls a little flat for me. We also diverged a little bit in that I thought that this could work better as a one-parter. Mm-hmm. You were saying, no, we would have lost too many good moments from the two-parter.
Yeah, episode. Like I really love the stuff with B'Elanna yeah. and then the female engineer.
Which I love too. And yeah. I agree that we would have had to lose that. But I think it just, this seemed one of the questions we always ask is, does this justify itself as a two-part episode? And I felt like they were stretching out a little bit of this one. So, and also the another kind of bland 90s, generic 90s man sort of villain that they cast here.
A little more memorable, though, than the guy in Unimatrix Zero.
He was actually given, like, a memorable characteristics. Yeah, yeah. So I'll take that. So, and again, a kind of strange, like, climax to this one where, I don't know. But Flesh and Blood, again, perfectly enjoyable episode. I praise it for kind of the strength of the ideas there. I just wish they had trimmed a little bit of the fat and kind of tightened it up. And I think they, I honestly, I still think that this would have been maybe a top, you know, 20 episode of Voyager if maybe it was a one-part episode versus a two-part episode.
This was my number 8, so I have it
pretty spoiling.
Close. Yeah, I have it pretty close to where you do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, for me, this is one that I really enjoy it. Like, it's a genuinely interesting story to me, this whole Doctor narrative with him meeting up with these group of holograms. I think the leader with the Messiah complex is actually really interesting. I love the way they set him up, where
he... Iden, I think, is his name.
Yeah, Iden, yeah. Where, like, he's very sympathetic. Where my issues with it come more in that the turn that he is this, you know, mad Messiah character...
He starts going cuckoo.
Comes out of nowhere, kind of. Like, exactly. It's not set up or layered in an interesting way. I would have liked maybe more of a natural evolution as to how we get there. And also, it's impossible to ignore the fact that as a Voyager two-parter, this is very mid-tier ambition.
Yeah.
Like, they are not going crazy with their, here we go, folks. It's sweep season. Here comes the ultimate hologram story. It's like...
There's a lot of sets and studios.
Yes.
You know.
It feels small compared to when you're talking about, you know, some of the other ones we're going to talk about later, or even an Endgame. Like, it does feel like a smaller two-part story. I just think it really works for me, you know, more so than the other ones below it on the list for me, in that, like, the Doctor stuff is fantastic, the B'Elanna stuff is fantastic, and Iden is a villain who actually feels like he has an actual journey that's interesting
for sure, and which we don't get a lot with, what, maybe Anorax in Year of Hell.
Totally, yeah.
But beyond that, like, it's kind of tough to find that with their antagonists week to week, especially for, well, not especially, but oftentimes for these two-part episodes. Mm-hmm. My number 8, though, is Future's End. I alluded to it by getting confused about the name of Past Tense a little earlier on.
I've done that many times myself.
This one is a pretty silly episode. Yeah. And by pretty silly, I mean very, very silly episode.
It ends with, like, the villain, like, frantically typing on an IBM computer, trying to, like, control Voyager.
Well, what do you think about Ed Begley Jr. as kind of the antagonist of this episode? I like him as an actor.
Yeah.
As a villain, it's like, I buy him as a villain, but is this a villain that you love to hate? I don't know. Like, he kind of seems like a bit of a turd. You know,
sure. Well, this is a very, like, light touch Voyager story, kind of like a Time's Arrow, you know, it's or even a Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Like, it's this very, like, light comedic story. You know, you've got Sarah Silverman in there as, like, Tom's, you know, new buddy, a scientist there.
Rain
Robinson, right? And again, like, it feels just like...
No, Rainn Wilson.
It's very comedic and bubbly. And he's a villain that I think kind of suits that. But do I ever find him threatening? Not in the slightest.
I don't know. It just kind of feel like all it would take is, like, one knockout punch from Janeway and his plan would be completely foiled.
Yeah, like, you needed, like, Tuvok to do, like, a nerve pinch right when he was, like, making some grand statement about his villainous plot.
There's also, you say this light touch, there's also some weird white nationalism in this one where, like, remember Chakotay and B'Elanna crash land in Arizona?
Yeah.
And, like, it seems as if some white nationalists captured them and they don't really kind of touch on that thread again.
But was that comedy in 1995?
I don't think it was supposed to be comedy. I think it was supposed to be social commentary at that point. But the thing is, like, they don't actually do anything with any of the social commentary. It's just kind of like the men are remarking on how these folks are different looking.
Right.
Which I was like, okay, well, what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. But they made it very clear that these were, like, some sort of, like, militiamen. And it's like, okay, so you're alluding to this white nationalism thing, which I think could be very applicable to what we see going on with a rise of lots of populist and nationalist movements throughout the world. The applicability doesn't continue on to this day, which is kind of like, huh, what were they going for in a light episode like this?
I mean, we commented on that in the episode review we did with Tony Galush was on that one. And I mean, like, we were just like, this subplot does not work.
It was bizarre.
And the thing is, the rest of it is pretty light and fun. Like, it's a really fun two-parter. And then you throw in that, and it's kind of like, well, it just feels like an engineered way to introduce some sort of menace in the second part. And it's, you know, it's to me, that's the lone moment where it stumbles.
It is also very important with regards to Voyager's mythology, though, because A, it introduces the mobile emitter, mm-hmm. and B, it also introduces Captain Braxton,
yeah.
who continues to appear in the show as, I guess, an ongoing antagonist to a certain degree. I don't know, at least for one more episode.
Right.
But so it is kind of an important episode for Voyager, more so than people might think. I don't know. I kind of have it ranked at number 8 just because it's more of a throwaway episode. It's perfectly fine and enjoyable to watch, especially I feel more like Neelix watching all the soap opera feeds sometimes when I'm watching this one. But it's a nice episode.
I mean, we're kind of in lockstep, one step removed, because okay. I have it at number 7.
Okay, okay.
And yeah, like, I enjoy it. It is definitely low impact in the world of Voyager stories in the sense of, like, when it's over, I'm not like, wow, that was an adventure.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, that was fun. I really enjoyed that. And what I like about it is that it pairs off some characters in an interesting way. Like, I do love the Tom and Tuvok pair off. I think they're fun together with, like, Tom trying to convince Tuvok to take his shirt off.
Yeah.
At the beach, you know, and just like weird moments like the roller skater between Chakotay and Janeway. Like, it has those kind of fish out of water moments that really worked in the Voyage Home. And that still work here.
Okay, so we agree this is probably the lightest Voyager two-part episode. What is the lightest Deep Space Nine two-part episode?
Oh, I mean, they don't really have one that I would say. I mean, you could... Oh, boy.
They're all kind of serious ones, right?
Yeah. There's nothing that's jumping to mind at all because you go, well, like, the earlier ones are the ones least likely to be as dark because the show gets a lot darker later down the road.
Yeah.
But then you're talking about, like, Past Tense and the Maquis, which, you know, they're not laugh fests.
Past Tense is a very dark one. I would never put that one up.
No, I'd remove that
one.
So maybe the Maquis?
Okay. I guess Dukat had some fun moments. Sure. When his uniform came off coming out of the airlock.
Maybe DS9 just knew that it was tough to stretch a really light, fun story for 2 hours, which Voyager was like, we don't care, we'll do it anyway. And you know what? They pulled it off in Future's End, which is a fun episode.
So it came. Now we're getting onto my number 7, which is where I find I'm genuinely like really appreciating these as Voyager episodes. You know, like I think that they kind of take a step from me feeling a little like, oh, yeah. To like, oh yeah, this is good stuff. So I'm going to give number 7 to Workforce here.
Okay.
I am higher up on it, but you still are a big fan of this one. And so, you know, just for the reasons I said before, this one is kind of much deeper than I ever remembered it being. And I would just say that, you know, give it a watch again right now and you'd be surprised about what you're taking away from it. And they do so many things right. I think they knew by this point, this is how you do kind of a two-part episode, especially keep in mind, every single character has something to do. And mm-hmm. we would see in a lot of these two-part episodes, a lt, you'd say what, like 6 out of the 9 cast members would be neglected
you know,
throughout it. Everybody had something to
do. Neelix was almost always ignored.
Yeah, but Neelix, he was even like helping take care of like the ship while it was just like the skeleton crew. And like he had stuff to do though. Like remember he was like nursing people that would slowly be brought back to the ship and he was helping them like reignite their memories. Like
he's the morale officer.
That's his job. So it's cool to see Neelix get some cool things to do. So Cam, what is your number 6?
My number 6 is Caretaker,
the pilot
of Voyager. Which is, I think, you know, one of the better, stronger pilots for Star Trek.
I think
we're going to do a pilot episode sometime down the road. But, like, I do think Caretaker introduces all of the characters very well, better than pretty much almost any of the other pilots.
Did you just call them characters?
I hope I didn't.
Okay.
I hope I would have never said that.
Go on.
I'd be embarrassed if I said something like that. But like, I love the way it introduces the characters. It establishes the world of the Voyager ship really well. You have a really fun, really kind of wacky sci-fi idea of the caretaker and his little farm community. And then you...
I wish they had the entire series take place in that barn.
No kidding. And then you get the whole setup for the show, and it's done in a way that feels really compelling. Like, when I look at the DS9 one, it does a lot of the same thing. It's pretty good with the characters, but it feels like it's more obsessed with its own self-importance of the mythology versus how do we make this fun for the audience?
Yeah.
And I think that's something Caretaker does really well. And when it's over and you have Janeway giving that big speech on the bridge, I'm in for the series. Like, it really does work.
This is exactly what you're supposed to do with the pilot, though. Like, you're supposed to establish what the premise is of the series, who all the characters are. And as much as I like Star Trek Discovery, those first two episodes, I remember the night that we watched those first two episodes at Vulcan Hello and Battle of the Binary Stars.
Yeah.
It did none of those things. I mean, I was intrigued what the show was going to be giving us week to week because I had not a clue, considering we had only met like two of the main cast members at that point.
Yeah.
It was, well, I guess technically three if you want to include Voke. Sure. You know, but Voyager did it. They nailed it right out of the ballpark. And I want to think about it kind of in a vacuum to a certain point, because I think I'd be more down on it, because I actually have it higher up than you do. I'd be more down on it if I knew what was to come, and that, like, they have this great premise where you're going to have, like, the Maquis and the Starfleet officers, you know, kind of a lot of conflict going on. They got rid of that by episode two, and, you know, it's disappointing, but look, the premise is intriguing. The characters all have a lot of cool nuance to them. I dig. This is a strong one here.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Okay. So for me, my number six is Year of Hell.
Okay.
And this one, for the longest time, I just could not get over the reset button, you know, that went off at the end. You know what? To quote Harry Kim yet again, to the journey. Like, this is kind of a character study on what Janeway is willing to do for her ship and her crew. And take it as that, kind of like a one-off sort of deal where maybe it doesn't really affect the timeline at all, or does it? I don't know. We do see that ominous shot of Anorax at the end.
Yeah, very reminiscent of, like, the X-Files, where at the very end there would always be a shot of, like, the monster, you know, emerging from the shadows somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this one, like, I think, like, it is a great high-concept episode, but it's hard for me to have an emotional investment moving forward, even though they're, like, think about the stuff with Tuvok and Seven of Nine, where, you know, Tuvok loses his eyesight.
Yeah.
You know, there's some fantastic stuff, and this is actually a pretty good cliffhanger. We actually couldn't remember what the cliffhanger was a couple months ago, but then as soon as we remembered it was Janeway dispersing, like, the crew, we were like, oh, yeah, that is, you know, just something to behold, though.
And it means something for the character and the show, like the world of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, this is one of the strongest high-concept episodes that Voyager ever produced, and I think it only speaks to maybe the strength of some of the other two-parters we're going to discuss soon with regards to why I have it ranked at number six, right in the middle of the list, but definitely on the high side of the middle. So.
Right. Okay, well, my number five is Dark Frontier.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Like, this is, to me, like, so memorable. I think Susanna Thompson, her introduction as, like, the Borg Queen is absolutely fantastic. The drama between her and Seven is just very intense. This is a really intense story. And I could understand if, like, some people walked out of this one or turned it off when it was over and were like, I didn't really enjoy that. Like, it's very dark.
It was a heavy one to get through. And it is interesting that a lot of fans don't really talk about this one. And it's not as if I hear bad things about this one.
No.
It's just, I think it's just too heavy. Just think about, like, the assimilation scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is,
that whole, like, flashback or whatever, that whole scene where they're assimilating these species. It's horrific stuff. It
might be, like, the darkest shit we've ever seen in Star Trek.
Did we ever do a podcast episode of, like, most horrific moments in Star Trek or anything?
We'll put that on the calendar.
Yeah, maybe we should, because, yeah, like, that is, to me, one of the ones that sticks with me the most. And obviously, it's kind of referencing, like, some World War II horrors and the Holocaust. Like, it's very unsettling. And the way that this story goes, to me, like, it's kind of the seduction of Seven by the Borg Queen and the kind of the dueling mother figures in Janeway and the Borg Queen and who Seven is going to side with. And to me, in terms of a character story, Dark Frontier is sensational, but it also has so much imagery and just moments involving the Borg mythology that when it's over, I feel like I have a more layered and deeper understanding of the Borg than I get out of, say, Unimatrix Zero, or just some of the other, you know, Unity, or some random Borg episode that they throw in there, the Borg children stuff, where it's like they're adding to the mythology, but not in a way where I'm like, holy smokes, like, I'm really, like, blown away when it's over. Like, Dark Frontier, like, shakes me and makes me feel the horror of the Borg again, which, even by TNG later on, I'm not watching Descent, like, oh my god, the Borg are so unsettling. And Dark Frontier brought it back.
I just wish this episode is about the Borg Queen trying to seduce Icheb back into the collective, you know.
That's the Picard season two.
Yeah, but look, just even stuff like the introduction of, say, like the Borg diamond vessel. Yeah. Like, there's just such iconic you know, images throughout this. This one, I think it just suffers from the fact that, as you said, Cam, it is perhaps the darkest, like, episode of Voyager we've ever seen.
It's very downbeat. It's
tough for, like, hey, one of those, like, fun rewatches, you know, like, which is easy to do with, like, say, Best of Both Worlds.
Right.
But this one, I just, it's not exactly one that you would necessarily think works on paper right from the outset, because it seems so heavy and it's very much a character study. But there's some interesting stuff, like the caper that they had going on in the Borg ship. That was actually quite well done.
Yep.
Even just the sets looked fantastic, yep. You know? So, like, this has got so much going on for it there. So, it's definitely high up on my list as well.
And this is the one, I believe, that also has the insane moment where they're showing the representation of, like, humanity in
what's
the form of, like, an
what's
underwear
so insane?
Where it's, like, an underwear model.
That's how I would show my humanity.
So, that, I mean, that's memorable.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I really love Dark Frontier.
My number five, Equinox. This is the aforementioned one where I said is probably, like, the weakest cliffhanger we've ever had in which...
It's so dorky.
All it is one of those wormhole aliens, like, flying at Janeway. And yeah. So we're left over the summer to wonder, oh, is this the end of Janeway? We all know coming back. No, Janeway's going to survive it. And guess
it would
what?
Be amazing if she didn't.
Yeah, like that's it's entirely new series going forward. So yeah. It was a really lame cliffhanger. Forget about that cliffhanger. Watch it just as, you know, back to back. And think about what the questions are that they're asking you. It's like, could this have happened to the Voyager crew? If the Voyager crew had to deal with as dark of a journey as Equinox crew, maybe they would have fallen victim to throwing their principles as Starfleet officers and Federation citizens out the window, you know?
Yeah.
What would that meant for maybe dealing with the Maquis? What if there's, like, kind of a lot of intriguing questions we can ask now? What if there's maybe more of a Maquis insurrection going on?
Uh-oh, insurrection.
I know. But, like, this one is... And also, just think about, like, the antagonist here with Rudy Ransom. Like, yeah. A, you got perhaps a badass, like, antagonist name we've ever had in Star Trek before after Khan, you know. But
and John Savage is great.
Oh yeah.
And he has Titus Welliver as his second in command. You got these two actors together.
Isn't it weird to see, like, a young Titus Welliver as kind of like this nuanced Starfleet, like, kind of like
fresh faced cadet?
Yeah, I know. He's like, what's his nickname? He's calling B'Elanna BLT.
Well, I remember you and I came up with so many stupid sandwich names. Yeah, yeah. It was BLT, yeah.
Mine was like tuna on rye, I think, or something.
Tuna
like
onion, wasn't it?
Tuna onion, which sounds disgusting, yeah. But yeah. But anyway, so beyond Titus Welliver, no, this is just such a great, great two-part episode. And, like, yeah. We kind of wondered, would this have been able to sustain itself as a Star Trek series? I think not, in that this would have been too hard to watch for seven straight seasons. But I'm glad that they kind of asked the question. I'll say this, like, it's a new era in TV right now. I think what you could do nowadays is, like, maybe once a season, you pop in on this Equinox crew and they just hint at it. And then maybe by season six, that's where the Equinox crew and Voyager finally meet. Like, what if you, like, you have 26 episodes a season. What if you see kind of like the Equinox, like, one episode every season, you know, like, and you could see kind of the damage going on over the years, the crew members that you're losing, you know, just like... I think that would have been kind of an interesting thing to do. But I know 90s TV, they would have never gone for an idea like that.
Maybe if you had, like, a fleet-based series, you could have one of the ships lost.
Sure.
And that you get over the course of, like, a season what's going on, like, over the course of their journey as the fleet is trying to find them. Like, something like that, where you could get that kind of Equinox story in an actual ongoing serialized narrative. That could be really cool.
Yeah. So, Cam, what is... I guess we're at number four now.
Yeah. My number four is Basics. Which, you know, when you say Kazon, you don't think this one would be high on a list of Voyager two-parters, but, like...
When you say caveman, you don't think so either.
Yeah. Giant lizards? Now, that's the reason it's a number four. I really enjoy Basics, and, like, it's one that went... The first time I saw it, I went in with very, I think, pretty low expectations because of the fact it's like, oh, we're wrapping up the Kazon and Seska.
Sure.
And at this point, I'd sat through a number of episodes featuring the Kazon where I was just like, this is just not that interesting to me. And this is, you know, after the Aaron Eisenberg one with, like, the young Kazon and stuff like
that.
Yeah, that
wasn't,
like,
the strongest.
No. And
although Aaron Eisenberg looked pretty ripped in that one.
He was good.
I'll give him credit for that.
Yeah. Oh, he was good in it. It's just the episode was kind of flat. But like when I got to Basics, I had no expectations. And then I was genuinely blown away by it. The whole story of like tying off the arc of Lon Suter, I thought was incredibly interesting. And like had a like a real strong emotion to it for a character that is a sociopath. The sense that like you never like sympathize with him, but you can understand why he wants to become better, or like how they finally got through to him and how he manages to find a moment of redemption in the story.
I mean, you know, it's weird because I wasn't necessarily expecting Lon Suter to make a reappearance after his first like murder, like earlier on in the season. Yeah. But with this, you know, him coming back. The other thing that jumps out to me, though, is how invested I am in kind of the characters' decisions and what led them to the point that they're at here. What can Tom do? Remember Tom's journey about him, kind of shoving Chakotay around
a little bit.
You know, like that was like funny stuff there too.
Yeah.
But like, or even just Chakotay's, and Seska's relationship, and look, Maj Kala. Yeah. Never an intriguing antagonist, but him and the whole like child sort of like storyline, that was actually interesting. It actually gave him some nuance there, despite the fact he was an abusive partner.
He's a douchebag, big time.
Yeah.
But like Maj Kala and Seska were two characters who never popped for me, although they should have.
Like I kind of like Seska, but Seska like Maj Kala. Like, she was, like, owning the room whenever he was in.
Sure, but, like, Seska's a character that, like, when I'm watching Voyager, I'm like, I feel like I should think this character is really, really fantastic.
Yeah.
And I don't. Like, it always feels like they're just not quite writing that great character. And
you just wanted Martha Hackett playing the Romulan engineer on the Defiant.
Of course.
Yeah.
But when we get to this final story in Basics, suddenly these two characters, who I really didn't care that much about through the first two seasons of Voyager, have these endings that make them so memorable. Like, you know, if you can exit and leave the audience wanting more, you've succeeded. Like, I genuinely, when all was said and done with these two characters, I was kind of blown away by their journey in the end, at least in the end.
The thing that I wasn't expecting to actually be all that gripped by was, like, the caveman stuff. Because it's like, we all kind of know how it's going to wrap up, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, those guys that are left on the ship, they'll eventually have to save the day.
Right.
It's mostly their story. But getting back to Basics, you know, it's actually kind of fun to watch Janeway lead this makeshift sort of community in this like literal Paleolithic sort of era. Like there's actually some fun stuff that's actually quite telling about where the characters are, their social dynamics, and them learning to communicate. Because we have these caveman people, and like that's what, you know, Star Trek's always been really good at, though, is like kind of those communications.
I thought you were going to say caveman. I guess.
I'm thinking about Genesis Riker.
Sure.
Yeah. So, I'm big on Basics. My number four, we just talked about it. That was actually Dark Frontier.
Right.
Very, very strong entry. What's your number three, Cam?
My number three is Scorpion.
Mm, okay.
Which, this is obviously Voyager's attempt to do best of both worlds, but this is a really fantastic introduction to Species 8472.
Think about that teaser.
Yeah. And just the sense that when this was over, I remember the first time I watched it, when this one was getting to that big climax, I remember thinking to myself, like, how the hell is Voyager going to get out of this? Like, this species seems unstoppable.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love the psychic connection between Kes and the 8472 as well. Like, it really does amp up the tension. You really feel the threat of the species in a way that you did when you watched Best of Both Worlds with the Borg and the Next Generation crew. Well,
think about the pile of Borg corpses that 8472 is responsible.
A very, like, alien, the Ridley Scott movie type image.
Yeah, or even just, and sad to say for Harry Kim, but him, like, laying on that hot sick bay bed and just, like, getting, overtaken by this stuff. It's like, oh, these are triped giant fluidic space flying sorts of aliens that we've never seen anything like this before. It was novel. It was frightening. Let's forget about whatever came of 8472, which is pretty lame. But
it's exceedingly lame.
Yeah.
But like as a two-part story, I think it just is like gangbusters. You have the introduction, of course, of 7 of 9 in the second part. Yeah. And just the relationship between Janeway and her crew and the Borg really works dramatically. It almost feels like it shouldn't. Like, it almost feels too convenient and too almost cynical to be like, you know what? Let's do a Borg two-parter where the crew has to work with the Borg. but it all really works. The writing is fantastic. And, you know, the cliffhanger's not great, where they're pulling, you know, the Borg cube is pulling Voyager or whatever.
Like, we knew Voyager was going to be safe 3 months later after they come back from the cliffhanger.
But when all is said and done and you get to this, it really does feel like a roller coaster ride with, like, something at the end that means something to the series, which is the introduction of Seven of Nine and how is this going to impact the show going forward. Like, it's a two-parter that leaves you wanting to continue to the next episode.
Yeah. My number three, we just talked about it. Basics was mine. I just think this is a... People will be surprised by how strong this episode still delivers at this point. You know, I know it's very early in Voyager's run.
Yeah.
Literally their second, you know, multi-part episode or feature-length episode. But to me, I always love... much more than exploding consoles, but like kind of the character stuff that adds up to the end and how Janeway's decisions eventually brought this to the point where she's losing her ship.
Yeah.
It's not the first time Janeway, or it is the first time Janeway loses her ship.
First
of many, but it's interesting to see how she handles it, at least this first go around. Cam, what's your number two?
My number two is Equinox.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, we talked about already, but like Equinox is an episode that I didn't go in with any real fanfare. You know, when I watched, you know, some of the other ones like Scorpion, I knew going in that this was a very important two-parter and that people really loved it a lot. Whereas like Equinox, I'm sure I'd probably heard the name, but it didn't necessarily jump out to me. And I was blown away at this story, this Dark Voyager, you know, two-hour story, you know, like a dark take on what would happen if Voyager had gone on the journey that maybe some fans would have liked to have seen. I don't know if it would have been that pleasant for 26 episodes, 7 seasons, but...
That's why I said just one episode a season.
Exactly, and I'm with you on that. But no, like, it's incredibly compelling stuff. Even though it is very dark, it doesn't feel, like, miserable to sit through. It doesn't have the heaviness that you get with, like, Dark Frontier, I can totally understand why people would be like, I didn't really enjoy watching that one. I feel like Equinox really works because you have like this Rudy Ransom character who just pops on screen and he's just so interesting.
So I think we've already discussed both our number ones at this point. Why don't we just kind of count down, count to three. We'll both say them at the same time. Then maybe we can have a debate because I think our picks are probably the ones that most people debate amongst the fandom there. So one, two, three, Scorpion.
Year of Hell.
Yeah. So for those that didn't catch it, I went with Scorpion, Cam with Year of Hell.
Yeah.
These are pretty much always at the top of these lists whenever people, you know, kind of talk about this stuff. I don't know. Let's have a debate. Why is Year of Hell kind of your number one Voyager two-parter?
I feel like Year of Hell does for the two-parter what you really want. It is like a motion picture. It's like Voyager the movie, where you have this self-contained, incredibly exciting story with like massive stakes. You know, you referenced it earlier, Janeway sending her whole crew off. Ends with Janeway ramming the ship and being like, time's up. It's like the ultimate, like, Michael Bay explosions, you know, like, it's just incredible. Nick Cage hair flapping in the wind. Like, it's the moment that I just absolutely love. I find Anorax to be an incredibly compelling villain. I think Kurtwood Smith does a great job. I love all the James Bondian stuff with Chakotay and Tom Paris.
Eating having, like, baguettes.
Yeah, eating baguettes with him. Like, it's just...
Cheese. like for those that don't remember,
like
Anorax would go to these alien planets and save one thing before he'd wipe them from the timeline, and it all seemed to be food related. It's like, forget about artwork.
It's like olives and baguettes.
Like, okay.
But like, to me, this takes like kind of the best of like blockbuster pop culture and puts it all together into a Voyager story that's very character-driven with Janeway.
Yeah.
It gives the entire cast interesting things to do and is all tied to this high-concept idea that is just, you know, that has a fantastic antagonist that all just comes together as, like, to me, like Voyager the movie in a really, really big bad way.
Yeah, for me, Scorpion, I think this just might have so many of those iconic moments that all the fans are still talking about now.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, there is kind of, like, the setup with everything, establishing, like, a really cool villain that we'll still have some cool villain episodes left for them, you know, look at episode, like, Prey.
Sure.
But you're also kind of setting up the future. Like, what is a story that they want to be telling? And I think this is, like, a big marker for like a big change in Voyager moving forward. It goes away from more of those character-based sorts of stories week to week into much more of the high concept stuff, and you can kind of feel that. Think about that exchange that Janeway and Chakotay had in the briefing room, where he's literally talking about, you know, the Scorpion and the Fox going across the river, and it's just in the Scorpion's
nature. And the Frog.
It's a,
does it change a lot?
It's one of those folktales changes all the time.
Right.
I've heard other varieties as well, where right. it's not even a scorpion or a frog or a fox or, there's, but look, so we've got the character stuff down and also just kind of setting up about what the character stuff is to the future. We've got the seeds planted for the very stupid departure of Kes, but we don't actually have to deal with that just yet. We can wait until the gift, at that point. But we also have kind of the seeds planted for one of the best characters of Star Trek ever, which is Seven of Nine, and like just establishing her there. What a distinct looking kind of like person that, again, not a Starfleet officer, not even a key member who's been integrated to the crew. This is somebody who is literally against what everything that Voyager stands for. This is kind of a fascinating setup. And I just love pushing Janeway to the brink. That's what Voyager does best. And like seeing what she'll do, how she'll overcome, goes to show that both of the episodes that we picked, it's about kind of pushing Janeway to the brink. We are blessed to have Kate Mulgrew as kind of the lead in a series like this.
She has a badass moment in Scorpion where she's on the Borg ship and it's like pitching its deal. And she's just like, no.
Yeah.
Like she's shooting down the Borg's demands.
No, they're so like, great. Give us the technology. No, you're going to assimilate us. No, please give it to us. No, you need to help us first. Give it to us.
You win this round, Janeway.
So, Cam, as we think about kind of these 12 episodes here, these 12 adventures here, what's your biggest takeaway about what Voyager's doing with these two-part adventures versus DS9 or TNG? And let's be honest, to a much, much lesser degree, TOS, which I don't even think it counts. It's an entirely different era of TV.
The only one you have is like The Menagerie.
Exactly.
Which was made out of desperation more so to fill time. But so like with Voyager, people talk all the time about how Voyager has the quote-unquote epic two-parters. And I really think that's what it is. It's like Voyager, when it's firing on all cylinders, creates two-parters that feel bigger than any episode you'd get. Not just in terms of length, but like we're going to do things that feel huge and epic and have like ramifications in some cases.
I think Dark Frontier might epitomize that the most, like that one just blew us away when we did the podcast a while back.
But when you look at like the DS9 ones, the majority are all very mythology based. It's more about how do we expand the mythology and give people those kind of dramatic bombshells that are going to impact the show going forward. Voyager doesn't really do that much. I mean, yes, you have the introduction of species 8472, so that is going to affect the show a little bit, not as much as I would have liked. But, more so, it's like, let's just tell these slam-bang two-hour stories. And when they're over, you feel like, wow, like I can't wait to see what they do for their next two-hour story, because I have to imagine fans are probably counting down or more excited about Voyager two-parters than maybe like DS9 two-parters.
Well, these were events. I remember watching it at the time, and they were always big, big events.
Do you remember the event they created around the Dark Frontier one?
Not really,
it was Dark Seduction Week.
Oh, really? Oh, that sounds kind of familiar now.
Yeah, UPN, they had their own graphic. It's a Dark Seduction Week.
Wow, okay. Dark Seduction sounds like my goth band back in high school. But,
Yeah, sure, high school.
Yeah. So, I'm looking through this list. I'll say that maybe there's only two episodes I consider duds. There's Unimatrix Zero and Endgame. The other ones I find kind of at least rewatchable kind of romps.
Yes.
Not that I would consider Dark Frontier a romp, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
even the ones lower down, they're solid episodes.
Exactly.
Whereas, like, even like I look at Unimatrix Zero and Killing Game, which are at the bottom of my list, I can't say that they weren't trying to do things bigger than your usual Voyager episode.
Yeah. So, look, Voyager, like, I think it deserves maybe a second look from a lot of people for all the episodes involved here. It's going to be fun because I was looking ahead at what Enterprise has in store for us.
Not a lot.
Only six.
Yeah.
So that's kind of crazy for us to kind of tackle that moving forward. We'll be done that much quicker. Cam, we might have it done in time for, Star Trek Picard. I think we both kind of want to finish this up before we get kind of waylaid by Star Trek Picard coverage that we'll be doing in the new year. But hopefully we can keep on schedule and get all of these Enterprise two-parters in. And then we'll have a lot of fun with, maybe we can kind of judge all the series more holistically on what these multi-part episodes actually mean.
Right.
Because look, Discovery, Picard, it's a new era. It's all serialized. There's no such thing as like a two-part epic anymore. Although I guess we did get it with Sweet Sorrow parts 1 and 2.
And I mean, it's not really a two-parter, but kind of it is the introduction, the first, like, yeah. two episodes of Discovery.
It's a one-night event. I guess we could, like, kind of think about that. Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah.
So, look, Star Trek, it's part of its DNA at this point. It's one of the few shows, like, back in the 60s, they're doing literal two-part episodes. So, yeah. It's kind of fascinating to kind of watch this evolution of two-parters. Maybe that could be an episode that we tackle further down the road, too.
Possibly. Now, before we sign off, we should just recount our lists in case people can't keep track at home. Why don't you start?
I'm shocked that our listeners aren't taking, like, avid notes, but, for me, number one, Scorpion, two, Caretaker, three, Basics, four, Dark Frontier, five, Equinox, six, Year of Hell, seven, Workforce, eight, Future's End, nine, Flesh and Blood, 10, The Killing Game, 11, Endgame, 12, Unimatrix Zero.
Okay, and here is my list. At number one, Year of Hell. Number two, Equinox. Number three, Scorpion. Number four, Basics. Number five, Dark Frontier. Number six, Caretaker. Number seven, Future's End. Number eight, Flesh and Blood. Number nine, Endgame. Number 10, Workforce. Number 11, Unimatrix Zero. And number 12, The Killing Game. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Well, we just wrapped up the Voyager two-parters, which means that we get to kick it off with Broken Bow, the series premiere of Star Trek Enterprise, or as it was known back in the day, Enterprise.
it's been a long time getting from here to here.
Yeah. I cannot wait to tackle this one. Like, yeah. It's going to be kind of cool to put everything to perspective all these years later, and I'm very excited.
Decon gel in the house.
Cam, I've been making some here at home for us to put on as we do our podcast review. So for all those listeners at home that hear that, that's just us, like, gooping it on our arms as we record. So
next week's video is going to be something else.
Yes, please go to YouTube and watch.
Yeah. Okay, you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V is in very annoyed he didn't make a Mortal Kombat Scorpion joke. Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in 9, comma, 7 ofs, lame 90s generic boyfriend.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.